Gettysburg Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast. Conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more. With voices from around the corner and around the globe.
This is Kristen Johnston-Largen here with the Seminary Explores, and my guest today is a dear friend and a very interesting scholar, my colleague Maria Erling, professor of church history here at the seminary. Maria, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So glad to have you. Well, Maria and I, we teach confessions. We've done this for several years now, and I am a theologian, and Maria, you are a historian. And so we come at the work in very complementary ways, I think, but of course very differently. And so what prompted, just so you, dear listener, understand, what kind of prompted this, the beginnings of this conversation was Maria is just back from sabbatical, and so we had her post-sabbatical review. And Maria, I just thought it was so interesting when you were talking about all the archive work that you have done and some of the questions that you've been exploring related to the larger question of how we understand American Lutheran identity. And of course, from my perspective, I think about the theological issues that are dividing and uniting. And I think there has been, I mean, what I was hearing you say and what I've now been thinking about is that there's been this kind of almost exclusive reliance on that and not enough attention paid to the way Lutherans were engaging the different issues of society in the 19th century. So, yeah.
Well, I think what I would like to introduce as a concept is the idea of the context in which an argument happens.
Oh, good. Say more about that.
So we are familiar with this concept that context can really affect how we interpret things.
Sure.
And so when we talk about Lutheran identity in the 19th century, we're talking about a very interesting period of time when many things in the context are changing for Lutherans. So first of all, in America, you have Lutherans who come from different backgrounds, and so they're experiencing this new context of America with different sets of lenses. So some have come out of discussions in Germany that already have to do with lots of fighting about Lutheran identity theologically as Germany's society is changing. Then you have Scandinavians who are coming, some from revival backgrounds and other movements, and then they're plopped together in the United States, and they have to figure out what is going to be their American Lutheran heritage then. And already in the United States is this American Lutheran brand that has been designed and articulated and worked really through many other issues by Samuel Simon Schmucker here at Gettysburg. So we have a very complex theological, cultural, devotional experience of trying to find these different Lutheran groups. Do they recognize each other as Lutherans? Do they not? And in the traditional history, they have focused especially on the way that the Lutheran confessions function in the middle of this debate, too.
I want to ask you about that. Just I'm going to break in. When you think about the sort of classic history of Lutheranism in North America kinds of texts, is that, would you argue that that's been the primary overarching structure? I mean, you know, the way that those were organized?
Yeah. Well, how do the historians argue when they're putting together a narrative of Lutheranism in the United States? And Wentz, who really took the first stab at this that had a really national readership, was arguing that Lutheranism is genuinely an American phenomenon, and it relates to American experiences. It's not some kind of import. And that he shows all the way through his history how much the American experience reflects the issues that are happening in this new context.
Okay.
Then later historians are saying, well, you know, those arguments about the confessions, etc., really are external to the American context. They come in and they really disrupt this kind of easy evangelical Lutheranism that had emerged. And they want to give more attention to the critique of that American Lutheran experiment. And, of course, the big issue is this document that Schmucker and a few others had designed that was a rather strongly edited version of the Augsburg Confession. And he drafted this definite platform in 1854 and circulated it. so that it could be accepted as a articulation of a definite Lutheran platform.
Nice.
And not some vague experimental accommodation to Methodism or all these other things. No, this is definitely. But what he had done is taken out some distinctives like the real presence and the sacrament of Christ. He had said that the Sabbath was, in fact, something that was a confessional plank and not as Luther had done.
Okay. So it was a little controversial.
Regeneration and all of these things. I mean, so that he had really picked up a lot from the revivals. Well, of course, this was completely denounced. So now here we are in the 21st century. What do we do with this debate? Gettysburg has been branded as being the definite platform, American experimenting so carelessly with the confessional documents. So I'm a scholar now thinking, well, meanwhile, in the 1850s in the United States, there's this major debate going on about slavery.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
And that has seemingly no relationship with the confessional arguments that are going on that are splitting Lutherans. Okay? So what do you make of that in the historical accounts, that the same people who are taking very diametrically opposed stands on slavery are at the same time splitting, ostensibly, over whether or not they take the full confessional documents as they are received or not? And the fact also is that the confessional documents hadn't even been translated into English until 1856. So you don't have, this is not an argument that lay people are having.
Sure,
you know?
Sure,
and
right.
Even the theological, if you look through what Schmucker was teaching the students here for the decades that he had from the 30s and 40s and 50s, there's no class on confessions.
Really?
No. I mean, it's just not.
Huh.
It's not an item of controversy.
Yeah, interesting.
So it gets introduced as an item of controversy based on an argument that's going on within Germany about the state, the nation, imposing a new confessionalism.
Huh, okay.
And people reacting strongly against that. No, that's not the business of the state to do this. So they flee. They form a new kind of Lutheranism. They look at what's going on in the United States. And they, at the same time, are taking stands on whether slavery is something that a Christian can accept or whether or not it really has to be fought against.
Yeah.
So what my research is trying to pry out is whether or not there are underlying social commitments that relate to the understanding of the confessions and relate also to the understanding of this moral question about slavery.
Okay.
So, you know, a lot of people have worked about whether or not the church's development of doctrine.
Yeah.
Can there also be a development of moral perspective?
Yeah.
And how are they related?
Yeah, that for me is the interesting question. How are they related, or are they related? Mm-hmm. Is there a way in which you interpret the confessions and confessional identity that then would lead one to an understanding of a particular interpretation of slavery? Or is it the other way around, that you come to an understanding of slavery and then you're sort of trying to interpret the confessions in light of that? I imagine it's a little bit of both ends
going
back
instance,
and forth.
Most of the Americans who were debating about slavery were having a big debate about what the Bible said about slavery.
Yeah, sure.
Okay,
and we still have that debate today.
That got them in trouble. Mark Knoll's written this book called The Civil War is a Theological Crisis, and part of the argument he makes is that because the Americans that the Bible was not giving them clear directions, one direction or the other, that other resources needed to be used, and Lutherans, he argues, who had a strong confessional background could have approached this biblicism with their confessionalism, but because they were speaking so much in other languages, they didn't have any impact on the American debate.
Oh, really?
Okay,
oh,
so that's his argument.
Okay.
Okay,
do you
about
agree
Lutherans.
With it?
Well, on the one hand, I say, yes, the Lutherans could have said more, but on the other hand, I have this more pluralistic understanding of what the public discussion is.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so it's not one. It's not what New York decided was published for,
sure, okay.
or what Charleston did.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
There's also the fact that there was a lot of publishing going on among the Lutherans, but it wasn't in English.
Right, right.
And it still hasn't been translated in many places.
Okay.
So,
because the debate was really still among the clergy and the theologians.
Yes, of course it was
sure.
Among the theologians, it was among the newspaper editors.
Okay.
The Norwegian debate is the one that is the most fascinating, and there has been a very long monograph written about it by a Norwegian scholar.
Say more about that, Mary, and how you found some of that, where you were.
I was at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, and they are a group of Norwegians who straddled the connection with very conservative German Lutherans, and also within their midst, because they were in Iowa and Wisconsin, had strong union sympathies among the lay people.
So when you say conservative, how are you using that term?
Confessionally conservative.
Got it. Okay.
So you have Lutherans that are very conservative, but they're in Missouri. So they're in a state that aligns itself with the South.
Okay.
And that is, they have a seminary there that has a Norwegian professor. Because the Norwegian groups are conservative about the confessions. They want a sound theological education. They actually sent delegates out to research where they could send their theological students.
Huh.
They went to Columbus, Ohio, to see whether they would send them there. They didn't bother to look at Gettysburg. They knew
it was Sodom and Gomorrah there.
They already knew at that point this definite platform had been circulating. They knew it was not going to be a congenial place for their students to be. And it was too Americanized.
Okay.
So they knew that. So they sent out these delegates. They decide on St. Louis. The problem is, though, that secession happens. And in St. Louis, they're aligning themselves with the Confederate side. They are not making a strong statement against slavery there either. And the Norwegian settlers in Iowa and Wisconsin are all signing up to fight for the Union.
Hmm.
And the congregations are saying, we don't want pastors coming to us from this establishment in St. Louis that are with such friction against the views we take here in our congregation. So it was the lay people who were really saying, we don't want this.
Okay.
So they had to close the seminary in St. Louis anyway because it was too near fighting. And these students, or about seven or eight of them, came to the synod meeting of the Norwegian synod, and they decided that then and there they had to start their own school.
Okay.
Okay, so that's when Luther College gets started.
Okay.
But still they had sympathetic conservatives
on
their back. So they draft a resolution, and they put it before the synod assembly about whether or not slavery is a sin in itself, meaning that in every case, holding a slave is a sin.
Uh-huh.
Or whether it's merely an evil, a result of the sinful character that we all have. It's an evil that we would fight against, but it's not a sin in itself.
Oh,
okay?
That's interesting.
Okay, so it seems almost like a distinction without a difference.
Right.
But the idea was there was no place in the scriptures that calls holding slavery sinful. And
right.
There are clearly revered figures, St. Paul, Jesus never denounces. You know, they're following this literal biblical line. So they draft this resolution. It becomes called the Pastor's Statement. 28 pastors vote for it. And then there's synod delegates who just abstain. The same number abstain. 28 abstain and 10 vote against it. Then they decide that they're going to bring this home to the congregations. And one of the pastors who signed it, who was a Danish pastor who was serving this Norwegian synod, Klaus Clausen, revokes his vote for this publicly in the newspaper. And this sets off a very long newspaper debate about whether slavery is merely a sin, is a sin, or merely evil.
Yeah, interesting.
And they get themselves tied up in such knots they can't determine this themselves by democratic procedures. You know, I mean, this is part of this issue of democracy. You know, who determines? We still fight about that in our churches today. You know, can we vote on a theological statement? Vote?
Yeah,
really? You
right.
know, what kind of legitimacy does that have?
Yeah,
you know?
It's very interesting.
Right? So they send away to the theological faculty in Christiania. That was their name then. Oslo now is what we know.
Uh-huh.
And so they sent back, signed by these four professors, a statement where they kind of say, well, you know, we just think that it's not right to treat a human being as an object and sell that person, it defies their personhood. There's elements of that in that statement. The Norwegian Synod leader pockets it.
Oh.
Says, we need to wait for a more calm time to talk about that. Nearly we're at war. So they pick up the argument again after the war.
Oh. I see, when it's already been decided.
It's all been decided. So they pick it up after the war, and they launch into about 4 more years of dispute.
Okay.
So there you have the kind of problem of trying to figure out how can this kind of theological argument about something that doesn't exist split apart churches still?
Yeah, wow. And in those debates, were they relating it to confessional? Were they bringing confessional arguments to bear, or was it still primarily
mostly biblical
okay.
arguments? Though that's
yeah.
what I'm trying to decipher,
right.
because I haven't
right.
read carefully through all of the nuggets in it. They do bring in Martin Luther, at least the Missouri people do, on his statement against the peasants.
Oh, okay.
So that's a confessional connection. And
huh.
Melanchthon is implicated in that, too.
Okay.
They do use that. To argue on the conservative side that the abolitionists
okay.
are flawed because they're advocating rebellion against the social order. So I think what you really have is this bigger argument about what is this social order that God has provided for us. And you can see that the medieval theologians do believe that, you know, that God gives us this natural
oh, yeah,
social
sure.
order with fathers' rule
yeah, right.
and over their households
mm-hmm.
that include their slaves. So we have this now, but in America, people are changing their condition all the time.
Yeah, right.
So what's the theological side of that?
Yeah.
Revival. Oh, so that's what's really undermining huh. the predestination arguments of the Calvinists, that God has set in stone not only your social order on earth, but also your heavenly
yeah,
destiny,
right.
right? So the revivalists come along, the Methodists say, you can decide.
Yeah.
Right? So that, I mean, somebody would decide, if I can decide about whether I accept Jesus and my salvation, I certainly can decide to get out of this farm work and become
right.
a carpenter.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
I can decide
right.
to do that.
Right.
You know, that's really, or immigrants who have said, I decided I was leaving the
right.
village where my parents and my grandparents and everybody had us pegged as X.
Right.
And I decided myself to chose to come to the United States to be
yeah.
a free person and start over.
Right.
And I can do what I want to here.
Right.
I can be
right.
a farmer. I can be respectable. I can do all these things. Now, those kinds of moves
right.
that people are making, I think, have to have some kind of theological corollary.
Yeah. Oh,
you know?
Absolutely. Right.
So
right.
it's not like they are going to be convinced by an argument that is then going to turn around and tell them, well, just accept your lot in life.
Right. When it's so clear they
when
don't
so
have
clear.
To.
Yeah. And so,
right.
I mean, the slaves
That's
knew
very
this.
Interesting.
The slaves knew this.
Right.
You know, I can decide I'm going to leave.
Right.
I'm going to seek freedom.
Right.
They're resisting that. So, I mean, I think that they're at a very basic level, these Norwegian immigrants could see that what the slaves were up to was something they were up to, too.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And so why are they going to listen to some elite pastor tell them, you have no right to think for yourself?
Yeah. Huh. Mary, so then in the 21st century, looking back, I mean, how does that then, what are the contemporary ramifications of your thinking and rethinking
yeah.
about Lutheran identity in this way?
Well, I think what's really fascinating to me is that as a woman who became a pastor in the early 1980s, I always thought that was the real breakthrough moment when we really were looking at Scripture. It said that women should be quiet and not speak up and defer to their husbands. You know, I brought up in that kind of world that was coming apart, where women would be independently setting out on their own and deciding, yes, I can have a call to a congregation. It's frightening at the first time, because the only pastors I'd ever known growing up were men.
Sure.
Hadn't ever seen this model myself. And I'd always thought that the biblical arguments that had been launched against women's ordination came, you know, fresh into this discussion. But looking at this argument about slavery, I realized, oh, they're the same arguments.
Uh-huh.
You know, what to accept that it's the same use of Scripture against women's ordination, as is used against freeing slaves.
Yeah.
And it's the same kind of understanding of Scripture that today would say we have to put a break on understanding marriage in a new way.
Okay.
You know, so the Bible Belt that we have in our country corresponds with the old Southern pro-slavery discussion.
I mean,
it's the same line.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't, we really haven't resolved that dispute about how to use the Bible.
Yeah.
And the problem in the North about the anti-slavery argument was that they didn't have the kind of clarity in their argument and in their foothold in Scripture that the literalists have still. Have to live into that kind of ambiguity and to look at the spirit of something rather than the plain text has always been a weakness of the argument that would say we really need to carry the Scriptures with us, but we need to grapple with them in different ways. How do they still have an authority for us?
Right.
How can we, on the one hand, say we have to listen to this every, you know, every time we want to make a decision, we really have to listen to what the Scripture tells us. Meanwhile, we're weighing all this other evidence that we have to change the way we understand the way the family is structured, the way we decide what kind of opportunities people should have. So, I mean, it's a real challenge in a democratic, open society to claim that Scripture has, the old word would be authority. Does it have a voice in the discussion, and what kind of a voice does it have to determine how we should understand ourselves?
Right. Well, you could argue, I mean, again, I'm just thinking about this kind of going back and forth, that in some ways a democratic, using that again, just in the sense of a kind of a people oriented open debating kind of society, is actually the ideal context for interpreting Scripture. And in fact, context, because you, again, and I would say this is true, that's the way the Spirit works, right? I mean, there's something inherently in the Bible itself that calls out for this kind of reinterpretation. And we started this whole conversation with the importance of context.
Yeah.
And I think inherently in Scripture there is a lifting up and a recognition of that importance. And so you could argue that in some ways doing this kind of work, always paying close attention to what Scripture is saying, but hearing it in a new way, paying very close attention to where you are also, is the work. And when Scripture is not allowed to be read that way, then it's actually stifled. So in some ways, I think this is the most faithful way, but of course it's also the most scary and risky and challenging and all of that. So much easier to just take a literal reading and say the people on the top are going to tell you what to believe and the hierarchy remains and it remains in all cases.
Yeah.
And you know, so it is.
Well, we had an example of this yesterday in class. In the Churches and Slavery class that I'm teaching, the students read an article that Alan Dwight Callahan wrote about the use of the text from Ezekiel of the Valley of Dry Bones.
Yeah.
Okay.
We just heard that at the Easter Vigil.
And we just heard at the Easter Vigil, he talked about how it had been incorporated in different canons and used at different times. Okay. The slaves pick up the Valley of Dry Bones in a different way. Mm-hmm. And you might know that spiritual, dem bones, dry bones. You know, they're going to be reconnected, they're going to be enfleshed, right? They're going to live again. And so he puts it within the narrative of African-American slavery, where you have, just like Ezekiel, you have exile, right?
Yeah.
But for the African-Americans who are picking up this story, they don't have the chance to go back to Africa as their homeland. They don't have this promise of resurrection as a people in a new land. They have to claim their territory in a different way.
Yeah.
So they're retrieving something from the biblical text and applying it to a dramatically new situation and actually changing the usage of it. So this is, there's a new concept that I am reading about in a biography, and it talks about decontextualizing and recontextualizing.
Uh-huh.
So that would be an another way to talk about reinterpreting.
Oh, okay.
Because of reinterpreting, I think, as a coinage,
yeah,
can be too personalized and subjective.
Okay. I mean, yep, I see what you mean. It's my interpretation. Yeah. I'm reinterpreting
because okay. I want to
yeah,
do this.
Sure.
So here's this idea of decontextualizing us, which we do all the time.
Sure. Sure.
It's a kind of a recognition that when the church incorporates something into the lectionary, it's or when you're preaching, you're actually
sure.
recontextualizing
sure.
something. You're decontextualizing and recontextualizing. And what are the limits and boundaries of that?
Right. Right.
Yeah. So you invoke the Spirit as a necessary part of an authentic Christian retrieval, or
right.
We would use that, historians would use that term retrieval, or sort of taking something and using it
yep.
in a new context. Or we would say, what do we have to do? How much do we have to recognize its original context, and what do we do with that, and then use it in this new way?
Yeah.
So confessions, can we do that with confessions? They're not biblical texts.
Right.
They maybe are more... Maybe it would be better for us to keep them in their context a little bit more.
Yeah.
And not suppose that they should be retrieved. Like, for instance, what does Walther do? Right after John Brown's raid, he's writing to his pastors in Lera und Vera. This is their... Mm-hmm. The first mention of slavery in an American Lutheran context comes out then. And what does he do? He picks up Luther's condemnation of the Peasants' War. Okay, so last week we heard a lecture from someone who was a Luther scholar who was talking about what was going on with the economy at the time. You know, and the peasants are saying, you know, well, we ought to have this property. We ought to have the right to our own labor. This Reformation is really coming at the perfect time for us to look at the social restrictions we have, the enclosures that they're trying to do and grab all this property for themselves. And this is coming at the perfect time. We take matters into our own hands. What does Luther say? No, no,
no, no, no.
Don't go that far.
That's not what I'm talking about. Yeah.
I'm only talking about theology.
Right.
And so I was sitting there going, listening to this, and there's a Finnish scholar who's also talked about this whole process of critique of the economy going on.
Mm-hmm.
And here comes Luther along with this idea that justification is a gift, free. At the same time, he's condemning usury.
Yeah.
Yeah? You shouldn't have to pay for anything. No, you shouldn't have to pay. No, it should be a gift. It should be a gift. Faith, a gift. So, isn't it obvious that he's reflecting at some level theologically on what's happening with the changing economy into capitalism?
Yeah.
It's obvious that this is happening at the same time.
Right.
Yeah? So, I mean, I think we just have to have at least that much detachment when we're interpreting.
Yeah.
That amount of distance
yeah.
so that we can see
right.
both parts of the binoculars can see
yeah,
and
right.
give us a three-dimensional
right,
picture
right.
of what we're seeing.
Well, and what I hear you saying is that when we recognize that documents like the Confessions clearly came out of a specific context
mm-hmm.
also, were not dropped from heaven, were not constructed in such a way that they were untouched, unsullied by, you know, thinking about
mm-hmm.
usury, and so then we realize, oh, well, then of course, then we do need to sort of deconstruct them a little bit, and also we have the freedom to reconstruct them. I mean, what I hear you saying is I think there's sometimes this danger of wanting to sort of pristinate theological ideas and sort of insulate them from anything that was going on,
mm-hmm.
which would then also keep them untouched from whatever is going on in a contemporary
it's a
society,
kind of soul
right?
and body dualism
yeah,
kind
right,
of thing
exactly.
approach to the text.
Right,
but I'm wondering,
right.
since you're a theologian and you use the terms of deconstruction and reconstruction, and I'm wondering whether or not the term decontextualize and recontextualize are equivalent to construction. This because
oh,
you moved right
no.
away into that.
Yeah,
and I
did.
So,
that's
I sat
funny.
There and I was sitting there reading because I'm reading this in another language, and I'm thinking, I wonder if this is just a take on constructionalism, or whether it is something new.
Yeah.
And so I was sitting there going, I'm so glad I'm going to get to talk to Kristen today, because
Yay.
I want to ask her that question.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, in some ways, right, and that's funny. I mean, I sort of just paralleled them in my head. But I think probably decontextualize and recontextualize is better, because I think deconstruction carries this sort of philosophical weight of categories that may or may not be appropriate in this context. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, I think the precision of and recontextualize is probably a little bit better than construction.
It gives a little bit more to the surrounding cross-disciplinary realities, the material realities, then a deconstruction or reconstruction could be a more internalized to the project itself.
Yeah, right. That's true. I'm thinking about, I mean, one example of what I think is this deconstruction, decontextual recontextualization is the post-colonial kind of that mm-hmm. sort of work that's going on, because that's another example of something.
Mm-hmm.
Even the lecture that we heard talked about at the same time that Luther's writing, right, there and living, there's these discoveries going on, and he mentions them. What did he say?
Well,
once or twice, hardly ever. And so that's in itself sort of fascinating,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I think that's an example of scholars that are trying to do this retrieval of saying, you know, what all of what was happening politically with colonialization, how is that affecting the theological articulations of the time, and how can we?
Yeah,
and to me,
yeah.
that's sort of a mm-hmm. context specific issue that's kind of interesting.
I think that's a very important guard that we have to sort of recognize how parochial Martin Luther was.
Yeah,
in his actions.
Right.
Because here he is trying to appeal to Charles V, right?
Right.
And Charles V has been operating with the "I've got to purge my country's Spain of all these, all these non-Catholics. I need to be purely Catholic so I'm worthy of taking over the responsibility for this whole Western Hemisphere." He's starting a slave trade.
Hmm.
You know, all of this stuff is happening, and he's trying to purify his own country. What are the odds that he would receive favorably from Martin Luther and Melanchthon a reform document?
Right.
What are the odds?
That seems to topple the orders.
Topples it. What are the odds?
Yeah.
I mean, a kind of a zero to zillion.
Slim to none.
That Charles V is going to take this seriously, right?
Yeah, right.
And yet we've come through a period of ecumenical discussions with Roman Catholics saying, oh, well, these are just little tweaks, you know? And that this should have been something that would have been understood as a part of this purification movement. Maybe. And so you get these kind of abuses that we want to, you know, reform. Marriage of clergy and all these things that would change dramatically the economic situation of the churches.
Right, right.
I mean, are we naive?
Yeah. Maybe. A little. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think again, we live in a context where the Lutheran Church is dividing, and it's often over biblical and confessional issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, what I hear you saying is this work, this better understanding of what was happening in the 19th century, can help us shed some fresh light on what's happening with the church now and what it means mm-hmm. to be Lutheran now, mm-hmm. and how to understand that in a way that resonates for people that gives meaning. Right? I mean. I think
it's been really exciting to think about the history of this particular seminary here at Gettysburg, because it is the oldest seminary we have, and it's lived through all of this period of time.
Yeah.
And I think that it's wrestled with this a lot, too,
in different
generations of leadership that have been here at this seminary. It has taken it has taken its role very seriously as articulating a kind of adaptable Lutheranism without apology for its past. It's had to reckon with it. Probably might have wanted to forget some of the moments of its past.
Yeah.
But it has taken some very interesting moves. It's been unabashedly proud of its Lutheran heritage, though others have, you know, questioned whether it's really Lutheran at times during its history.
Yeah.
And it's it's really, we can be very proud of the kind of legacy that we have at the seminary.
Yeah.
Dealing with these issues.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's not all on us. You know, that's one of the things that I like about the seminary's long history, is that we might make a contribution towards it, but it's not like,
yeah,
you know, it's all on this generation.
Right. Well, Maria, let's close this, what's going to be our two-part conversation here, with what kind of bringing now back to the focus, thinking about the seminary, and talk a little bit about what you discovered about Samuel Simon Schmucker and his in his personal letters and his correspondence about his wife. And because one of the things that we also talked about is you have this very public, for these figures, they're sort of public statements, they're public face, but then when you go into archival work and you look at personal letters that were being written, the way in which they said some interesting light on that, and how I just thought that was interesting, and, you know, again, I think there's a mirror, right? I mean, the church also has a public face, and then it has its little sort of private debates, that are skirmishes that are going on, so I don't know. I thought that was interesting, too.
Well, one of the things that comes to mind, first of all, is something I learned from my dissertation advisor, Bill Hutchison, and he he pointed us to an observation made by a very famous historian during the war, the Second World War. His name was Herbert Butterfield. He was an English historian, and Butterfield said that the job of the historian is to become so well acquainted with the sources that you become aware of the predicament that everyone lives with.
Huh.
So that you can sympathize and understand
that they
made the choices that they made, like we do in the predicaments we face.
Yeah.
So that we shouldn't think of our job as to pass judgment on the past, as though we are judge, jury, whatever.
Right.
So when we look in these archives, we're certainly going to find things that are going to really challenge our assessment of a person.
Yeah.
So for Schmucker, for instance, it's very, you know, we certainly can't call him an abolitionist because that term had such negative connotations. It would be like calling him a terrorist.
Huh.
Because it was just a very, very sharp turn. It was somebody like John Brown who was going to go into someone's yard and slaughter someone.
Okay.
You know, that's immediate. That was all the connotations of an abolitionist. And so that when those would print documents that would call for abolition at that time, the mobs would come and burn their printing presses and kill them.
Wow.
Because it was a very violent a very, very violent exchange. Just like we'll go and wipe out terrorists. No, those of us who have studied this realize that today terrorists can be idealistic, too, and they may be just taking violence into their own hands, and there might be a way to understand a terrorist or a young person who decides to sign up to be with ISIS. I mean, at some point, we can't imagine that right now.
Right.
You know, what's wrong with
them?
Yeah. Well, their brains haven't fully formed or whatever, you know. But that's how they looked at abolitionists at that time. So he was anti-slavery, but he was not an abolitionist.
Okay.
Now, we use that term so broadly today, we want to claim that he was an abolitionist. But, you know, his wife, his wife, Catherine, second wife, wealthy Virginia family, they're going to move up here to Gettysburg in 1826. She wants to bring her servants with her to be in the household, because she's got to run a household, right?
She can't possibly do
it. No one has an electric washing machine.
No.
You know?
Right.
Right. Right? They don't. They don't have a refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
So he advises her about how young the servant means slave, should be, so that they aren't immediately free.
Because what was the rule?
They had to, until they were 28, remain in a household.
Okay.
And then they would be supposedly trained and ready to support themselves. So he advised her to bring with her and to emancipate them in Virginia. But once you did that, during the laws at that time, you had to bring them out of the state pretty soon. They didn't like a lot of free African Americans. So he advised her to bring someone that could be trainable to become the cook, who was still a teenager, and then she would get these years of service out of this person.
Okay.
So there's letters like that.
Yeah, right.
And then there's a letter later on in the 40s when he goes down to Frederick, and he's looking to purchase someone that would be, or to find someone that he would bring with him that would be also in this younger age. So he's maintaining a household where there are people in it that are warmly regarded as part of the household, but who are in a kind of indenture.
Yeah, right.
That doesn't give them freedom of movement outside of the household.
Right.
And there were people in the households around Gettysburg in refined professorial homes who needed to keep a level of hospitality and functioning that, you know, would involve some kind of servant in the household.
Yeah.
So you run across those things.
Yeah.
Which complicate your view of what really... And there were strong attachments that were there in those relationships also.
Right.
And greetings and people that... And when they retired, older servants came and lived in this household of Schmuckers too. So he took care of them.
Yeah.
So I was... there's much more to discover in the Seminary Ridge Museum.
Yeah.
Is helping with that.
Yeah, and we can help them also interpret.
Yes, we can.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I am looking forward to teaching Confessions with you again this fall to see how this kind of bleeds in a new way, perhaps. See how that goes, as always. And, so this is Kristen Johnston-Largent again here with Seminary Explores with my guest, Professor Mary Erling, and talking about her research on the churches and slavery and decontextualization and recontextualization, and thinking about the ways in which always our theological pronouncements and assertions are deeply influenced for good and for ill by the context in which we find ourselves. And knowing more about that helps us know more about where we came from and where we are.
The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, right?
Exactly. Thanks, Maria.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explores from Historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of Gettysburg Seminary. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.